Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday.
This is the Two Mats regular Q&A brought to you by the New European newspaper. So let's get going with our first question.
Let's get
please,
going.
Producer Matt. Hi, Matt. Given the dwindling sales numbers for daily print newspapers, why is it that politicians seemingly continue to be fearful of scornful headlines and allow that fear to influence policy? And that's from Andy Smith. Thank you, Andy, for your question. Matt, what do you think?
Well, I was going to throw this to you because you edit a extremely successful print newspaper.
I do. Thank you. And thank you for the compliment. And my theory is that they're not so much terrified of the actual newspaper headlines, but they're more terrified about how those newspaper headlines still continue to set the agenda in broader media, especially broadcasting. I can tell you that every morning editorial conference in Sky News, on the BBC Today programme, anywhere where there's a huge audience of people listening to the conversation about the day-to-day politics, it starts with an analysis of what's on the front pages. And that's why they're scared. And they're scared more of the Daily Mail than any other single organization and newspaper front page. And the Daily Mail, the tragedy of it is the Daily Mail will love to hear me saying that, but it's a fact. You know, and that's why so many politicians are terrified of people like Paul Dacre, the editor-in-chief of the Mail titles, who's been there for decades now, because he sets the agenda in large part for every other media that follows for the next 24 hours until the cycle starts again.
Yeah, and also online versions of newspapers have headlines too. So the headlines don't have to be just print.
No, it's true. And, this is why I know people like Alistair Campbell, for instance, during his time in politics with Tony Blair, was so vigilant about scrutinizing titles like the Daily Mail, because ultimately, you know, democratic society should be led by people we vote into power, not people who sit in, you know, editor-in-chief's offices deciding based on their own personal peccadilloes and political positions, how Middle England should think, you know. And that's become an obsession with both parties, you know. How does Middle England think? And that very concept of Middle England is very much a Daily Mail, Paul Dacre, and, you know, and
does it exist?
David English invention, you know. Does it even exist is a great question, but all politicians live in fear of it.
They do.
All right. I think we've made our position clear there. Andy, I hope that gives you some clues to what we think. Next question, please.
Should Leveson 2 be a Starmer first 100 days move? Well,
you take the lead on that one, Matt.
Okay, well, this refers to, for those who haven't been following the story, well, the story so far is that Sir Brian Leveson held an inquiry into the state of the press triggered by the hacking scandal 2011. And the first part of the investigation concluded with a kind of slightly... well, very kind of messy press regulation structure. There was always going to be, though, a second part of the inquiry, called shorthand Leveson 2, which was going to look at the relationship, corruption and so on between press, police and other public service institutions. And this is a very important issue and it should be investigated. However, I've got to be honest, Ledvinker, and thank you for the question. Do I think it should be in the first 100 days? I don't, because I think that Starmer's intray will be heaving with questions related to people's pay packets, the state of the public services, Britain's place in the world, the single market, and so on. And I do hope that it doesn't get shelved as it was, or it doesn't stay shelved as it was by Matt Hancock in 2018. But I think it's perhaps a little overambitious to expect it to be an issue for the first 100 days. But I hope it does.
Yeah,
it's a first-term issue, I certainly hope.
Yeah, and I also think that the terms of Leveson 2, whatever that means, should be reconsidered. That I think as time passes, these issues have become more historic, and we need something that deals with a much broader problem around what is a healthy media in society today.
Online media, social media, AI,
all of these things. How can they be constructive? You know, I think there's less of a case for looking in the rearview mirror now. We need to start looking forward about how these bigger problems around the way media has evolved since phone hacking and all of that. How can we produce a playing field where media actually plays a positive role in society rather than a corrosive one?
Yeah, 100%.
Next question, please. Okay, from Kenta Together. Your new European beverage report needs discussion. We need a 10-year vision and 5-year plan. Could the new European lead that? And this is a follow-on from an observation we made, that we should get stuck into a modern-day beverage report, which examining the state of society, basically, and how can we come up with constructive and, you know, innovative ways of improving people's lives. And I think absolutely right, Kenta Together, for asking that question. Matt, what do you think? And by the way, I should just say that this is something we are now actively putting together. So you can look forward to the new European taking a lead on that.
Yes, no, it's a definite yes. And we're, you know, work in progress. I mean, for those who don't know, the Beveridge Report was the 1942 investigation into the five evils: want, disease, ignorance, squalor, and idleness. So the question, I guess, is what would be the themes for a comparable report today? And there are all sorts of, candidates: climate, work, nutrition, loneliness, health, preventive and clinical, digital citizenship, housing, and so on and so on. And I think that the first task is actually to get the categories right, because, you know, this is not 1942, it's 2024. We keep saying, will someone please start the 21st century? And this is a good way of starting it. But I think it's a very important body of work. I sort of feel allied to that, is that the media generally are too fixated with how many Tory plotters can fit on the head of a needle, and the kind of ever decreasing circles of the death of this government. And it's time to start broadening out the debate into big, crunchy questions about what's wrong with this country and what the next government should do about it.
Yeah, great. Perfectly agree with that. And like I say, it's absolutely right down our street editorially. So the New European is actively working on this new report for 2024. Next question from Jonathan Hill, brackets, to be clear, not the Lord. Matt, you read this.
You mentioned in the podcast that the thinking of senior Labour people is still influenced by the 1992 election, which, of course, Labour lost. Unexpectedly, they believe that they can't get elected on a platform of better public services and bigger government paid for by more taxation, and that they will lose even by leaving wriggle room for that possibility in their offer. Are they right to think that? If not, how could they sell such a proposal to the electorate?
Well, I think that if that is what they're thinking, I think it's a potential disaster, and they're completely wrong to think that. I think the country, we've said this time and time again, is absolutely moribund, in a state of malaise, and is desperate for a sense of vision and new ideas. And the most important part of Jonathan's question is, how could they sell such a proposal to the electorate? And I do think that there's an unhealthy cynicism amongst the media, where people think, well, if you tell them that stuff's going to cost money, people will react against it. That's not the case at all. People know that we need to invest to create a new Great Britain. And I think it's all in the selling. And that, of course, was what Blair was so good at. And to give her credit, what Thatcher was so in tune with was the idea of communicating clearly to people in an emotional way, but one that made sense. And that's what I don't think we've seen yet from Labour. But they need to get a wriggle on, because people want a sense of purpose. And it's absent at the moment, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the, you know, 92 was 32 years ago. And I understand there's politicians suffer from PTSD. And, you know, are always fearful that history is going to repeat itself. But actually, at most, it rhymes. And I'm not sure it is the rhyme is right in this case. To your point, Matt, I think that actually this is a change election. And I totally understand Starmer and Reeves believe that they have to just win, and the ultra-cautious approach they've adopted. But there has to be a reason to vote for Labour, and there has to be some sense that this is a hinge election, that we're moving into a new era. There is going to be a new settlement and a new way of doing things, because people are really sick of where they've ended up, particularly since Brexit, particularly in the last 8 years. It really has been a terrible time in this country. And simply to say we're steady as she goes is not enough.
And I also just think, I mean, just to tie it back to our first question, is that they should remember that they don't have to be enthralled to the agenda of the Daily Bloody Mail. You know, they should be enthralled to the agenda of the electorate. And it will get through if they've got the right message. That message will get through, and people are thirsty for a sense of ambition and for a better, you know, a better future. That obviously sounds trite, but it's Starmer's job to make that, to articulate that.
And they won't win. I mean, you know, they talk about a decade of national renewal. Well, Keir, you won't win a second term unless your first term has some pretty big upheaval in it.
Exactly right. Okay, great. Next question. Thank you, Jonathan, for that one. Next question, please. From Steve B. Given the past week, could we see a narrow victory rather than a Blairish landslide? Or, God help us, even a Tory win? And if so, would the only sure way of keeping the Conservatives away from regaining power be electoral reform? Ditching first past the post might ensure we remain a democracy. Could this be the new big policy Labour should campaign on? And it doesn't come with a price tag for the Tories to attack them on. Okay, Steve, long but good question. What do you think, Matt?
I am not that... I mean, I always argue against complacency. You know, I don't think the deal is sealed until election day. So to that extent, you know, it's probably not a bad thing, actually, that Labour's had a bit of a shock this week. And it's been reminded that it's not in the bag. It's never in the bag until the votes are cast. I'm always nervous of electoral reform in order to bring about a specific result. I think there's a case for electoral reform intrinsically to do with fairness and to do with votes counting. But I don't like the idea that we ditch first past the post simply to keep the Conservatives out. I think that's actually gerrymandering disguised as virtue signalling. And I'm not persuaded that that's a good reason to embark on electoral reform. It's something that, you know, hasn't got a head of steam behind it yet. It may well do in times to come, especially as we seem to be fragmenting into smaller parties that will demand a bigger say. So the case will grow. But I, as I said, I'm personally a bit leery about let's reform the electoral system simply to stop the Tories.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think if we were both sitting down with a blank piece of paper in this new nation called the United Kingdom and deciding as founding fathers what our electoral system would be, then some proportional representation would be in that document. But the truth is that our system has relied on the representation of the electorate's interests being enveloped within broad, big parties, rather than having an aggregation of smaller political parties together. And that, if that works, that is a cleaner way of being pragmatic and being in government and making things happen. But it certainly has not worked in the last 14 years, I would suggest. And the sort of decomposition of the Conservative Party in the last 5 or 6 years, well, since Brexit, has been something to behold, and is an absolute bill of rights for a new political system. But I do agree with you, in principle, we can't just redraw stuff on the back of, well, they've been crap for the last 10 years. Let's make sure that never happens again.
Yes, and you also have to get into power under the old system before you can change it. So at this point, it's not an issue, and not one, I think, for the next few months. You know, it's definitely things to think about.
The flip side, I always think, of course, you know, how iniquitous it is that the Green Party could get 10% of the vote in places but get one member of parliament. But the flip side to that is that UKIP can get 10% of the vote.
Yes, absolutely.
And get, you know, no members of parliament, which is something I heartily concur with. Okay, so thank you, Steve B, for that question.
Matt, I've got a question for you. Do you know, on our fabulous range of merchandise, what is the most popular thing we've sold on the New Europeans shop?
I think I know, but you tell me.
I'll tell you what it is. It's a Bollocks to Brexit passport cover.
That's what I'd imagine.
Do you know how many we've sold in the last 2 years?
I would imagine a fair few.
2,500.
That's brilliant.
They're terrific. Vegan leather, it's called, which actually does look like leather. It's burgundy.
Pleather. Is it pleather?
Is it pleather?
I don't know. Vegan leather may be more cool than
leathery than anyway, it's been nowhere near a cow. That's the main thing.
No bovine mutilation was involved.
None at all. It looks passingly like an old-fashioned European passport.
Oh,
it's burgundy and it's got that golden crest on it.
I love it.
Except on the crest it says Bollocks to Brexit.
It's
all very subtle and nice and funny. Anyway, we've sold loads of them. People love them. And guess what? It's going to be our subscription offer for the next few weeks.
Happy days.
When new subscribers join the New European for as little as £1 a week, for which you get all of our digital content, all of your brilliant culture newsletters, everything we do online and full archive of newspapers and great features. Or if they spend another £1 a week, they get the newspaper, which has a retail price of £4.50. You can get it for an extra £1 a week, whilst delivered to your door every week for just £1 a week, you'll get a free Bollocks to Brexit passport cover.
Fantastic.
What could be better?
I don't think anything.
Imagine standing in the queue to passport control.
Imagine
ostentatiously
it.
Ostentatiously waving.
Just imagine.
Bollocks to Brexit passport cover.
The sheer
cover.
Sense of national pride.
Because you're in that queue for about an hour and a half.
International
now.
Pride and joy.
Yeah. Anyway, if you want to take up this fantastic offer, go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. That's the number 2, MATTS. Do it now while stocks last.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Next question, please. From Ben Valentine. I've just finished a really interesting book, Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism, by Yanis Varoufakis. He's the former Greek economic minister. It argues that we're already transitioning away from capitalism, not towards communism, but instead to techno-feudalism, where the big tech companies effectively operate cloud fiefs. Have you read it? Answer for me, no. I would love to hear your views. Have you read it, Matt?
I have, and I'm not a massive fan of Varoufakis, but I thought this book captured, well, a sort of fundamental, perhaps the fundamental truth about the way we live economically and culturally now, which is that, we are actually dominated by a tiny group of mostly tech companies like Tesla, Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, Meta. And what he argues in the book is that this is not in any sense traditional capitalism. It is a form of serfdom because we're just basically paying rents to these mega corporations. And all the claimed virtues of capitalism, competition, entrepreneurialism, and so on, are being quashed by these mega companies that actually are more like super nations than corporations. And I think he captures, this is not a wholly original point, but I think he captures a genuine concern. In the Gilded Age, big companies by antitrust laws were broken up. And the question which looms over the world now is there anyone able in the world of the multinational company to break up some of these mega corporations, to which there is no immediate answer, but I do think it's a good book, and it's a good way of understanding what's going on. That the problem is not just neoliberalism and capitalism and inequality, massive as those problems are. The problem is the aggregation of power in these mega companies. I mean, I saw, just as an example, Elon Musk teasing the other day that he might buy Disney. Now, Disney owns a huge section of the entertainment sector. It is one of the most powerful soft power agents in the world. If he was to own X and that, he would become by far the most important figure in information and entertainment in the world, already owning Tesla and SpaceX and The Boring Company and so on. And it gets to the point where, where's the accountability? The notion of market accountability is nonsense in that case. So I think the book does raise that, gives salience to that issue. And because Varoufakis has a following, it gets it into the cultural bloodstream.
Yeah, great. And I haven't read it, but I will do now. And great title, Techno-Feudalism.
It is good, isn't it? It's good.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Ben Valentine, for that question. Next question.
I read with interest Matt D'Ancona's review of Hills of California by Jez Butterworth. Thank you. I can't wait to see it. I think Jerusalem by Butterworth is the greatest thing I've ever seen on stage. I've seen it three times. What do you think is Butterworth's secret? Sheila from Berkshire. Now, I know you saw it the other day, Matt. What do you reckon?
I did see it. I thought it was more flawed than you thought it was, I think, perhaps. I was a bit... no spoiler alerts or anything like that, but I was kind of underwhelmed by the finale. It didn't have the power of the play Jerusalem, which is what Sheila's referring to, which I've seen. I think I've seen Jerusalem about four or five times. And the tragedy of this conversation, I guess, is that I don't think anybody will ever see Jerusalem again, because it's all dependent on the great Mark Rylance playing the lead role, who, and as time goes on, there's no doubt that Jez Butterworth is a genius. You know, I mean, it's such a wonderful storyteller, and with a sense of, you know, it's almost indefinable, but he manages to sort of capture a social emotion, doesn't he? That is.
Yes.
And it's never made explicit, you know, but it's woven within the lines of the play. Have I ever told you my Jez Butterworth story?
No.
So the first time I went to see Jerusalem, me and my wife went, and I was so blown away with it. I bought the screenplay, the script, whatever you call it for a play, as the book of it. And we went to the Ivy as a treat afterwards, right? Saw it on Shaftesbury Avenue, went to the Ivy for dinner afterwards, got a table last minute. And I was sitting there with the book on the table, and the waiter came over and said, "Oh, have you just been to see Jerusalem?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." And I went on and on about how this was like a life-changing experience at the theatre. I'd never seen anything so brilliant, a bit like Sheila. You know, it was like, I thought, this is wonderful. It doesn't get any better. And I went on and on and on. And the waiter said, Jez Butterworth was here tonight. He had dinner here tonight. And I was like, oh my God, so amazing, you know, brilliant guy. And as I was saying all of this, I was conscious that a couple of tables away, there was a guy who looked a bit like a fat George Michael looking over at me, tuning in, right? And I just, I had no reason to pay any more attention to that, except that the next morning I went onto my computer and Googled Jez Butterworth, and the photo of the guy, two tables away popped up, and it was him. And I thought, what a perfect form of fame that must be, to sit in a place and hear a guy enraptures about the thing he's just seen that you've written, but not to have to go the hassle of me coming up
having
fawningly ask for a selfie. But
no, it is.
Sheila asks, what's his secret? I don't know. Can you articulate his
secret? Well, I guess it's secret, but I mean, my intuition is, I mean, he certainly has a deep understanding and love of Englishness combined with a modern and quite liberal sensibility. And he has, one thing I think that's underappreciated about Jez Butterworth is that he takes his time. So part of the backstory to Jerusalem is that he had this sort of framework about a play about England and its folklore and its modern tensions, but it lacked a core. And he was living in the countryside, I'm not sure where, and racking his brains. And he befriended a guy in the pub who was essentially Johnny Rooster Byron, who was Mark Rylance's character. And that filled, there was a sort of Rooster Byron-shaped hole in the play. And because Jez Butterworth got to know this guy, who wasn't exactly like Rooster Byron, but very similar, that kind of finished off the masterpiece. Now, it's not quite the same, but The Hills of California is him channeling his feelings about his sister's death from cancer in 2012.
Yeah.
He's got a great ability, I think, to mix the social with the personal. And again, he takes his time. You know, a lot of people who have early success, who are hailed as the next Orson Welles, they feel a great pressure to turn out content. And I think he has an admirable indifference to that pressure. You know, he's done movies, it's a really good approach.
Yeah, and it's funny. I suppose if you asked, you know, 100 people in a motorway service station who Jez Butterworth was, maybe two or three would have a clue who you were talking about. But he is clearly one of, you know, somebody who will stand the test of time, I think.
Yes, and I think, you know, Jerusalem, I mean, look, it isn't bad. People often say, oh, you know, one hit wonder. I should be so lucky. You know, let's just say he never produces another play of the stature of Jerusalem. Well, you know, he'll still be remembered as the defining playwright of his decade, of that period.
Yeah. And The Ferryman was absolutely brilliant as well, which followed that. Next question, please, Matt. From Dan on Spotify. I am noticing Matt D'Ancona's penchant for initialisms and acronyms, SNL, MAGA. As a straight-talking sort of chap, do these irk Matt Kelly? Or can he start dropping in some of his own to even up the score? Thank you, Dan. They don't irk me, but I do have a reflex against acronyms that was sort of drilled into me early doors by sort of my foundations in journalism about being taught to be absolutely explicit and be, you know, well, I mean, this is slightly counter to the concept of brevity, because of course they are by definition brief, but so to have a clarity of language so that there was nothing in a newspaper article that somebody would say, what the hell are they talking about? You know, so no, they don't irk me, but I do, I know when you say SNL, Matt, I do feel the need to say you mean Saturday Night Live, just to some of the audience.
Think I did say Saturday Night Live and then SNL second mention, but it's true. I would normally say SNL and assume quite wrongly that the other person knew it. I think there's a sort of twist to this, which is sometimes acronyms can mean more than they do spelt out. So I think we've reached the point with MAGA where there's a kind of demonic sound to that word that is better than make America great again, right? And NATO just sounds better than the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It's a IDK. In general, IDK. Am I right? I think it's true. We should spell things out. Yeah, we should.
Yeah, no, good. And if anyone's ever interested, one of the best books written about journalese and journalism and how to write in good plain English is a book by the late great Harold Evans called Newsman's English, and it's a succinct guide. Well, it's quite exhaustive actually, but it's a very good comprehensive guide to how to communicate clearly. It's still in print, I think, and it's got my favorite ever complete news article in history, which I forget the exact location, but it's not relevant. And this was the whole story. It said, Ohio, Tuesday. Jim Robertson lit a cigarette while bathing his feet in benzene. Point. He may live. Point. So thank you for all of those questions. As ever, if you want to give us some feedback or ask us questions, which we love to get, please email us the questions to Matt's at tnepublishing.com. That's the number 2, MATTS at tnepublishing.com. Don't forget your subscription offer. If you like what you hear on these podcasts, you will love The New European. So please support our work by subscribing. That's the best thing you can do for us. And until our regular show is back on Friday, I'd like to thank our production team at Rethink Audio, led by Ollie Peart and Matt Hill. Until Friday, have a fantastic Sunday.
Happy Sunday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.